You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
From Vineyard Theatre in New York City, this is Theater Uncorked, where Vineyard artists come together to talk about the process of bringing new works to the stage. I am your host, Kevin Weinhold. The Vineyard is excited to launch its 2019-2020 season with Is This a Room?, conceived and directed by Tina Satter. Is This a Room? Was developed by Tina's company Half Straddle and had a limited run at the Kitchen Theater. The Vineyard is thrilled to be giving this show an extended life off-Broadway. In episode 12, Tina is joined by actress Emily Davis, who stars as Reality Winner, the former intelligence linguist who was arrested in 2017 for leaking evidence of Russian interference in the U.S. voting system. The word-for-word transcript of Reality Winner's FBI interrogation forms the text of Is This a Room? Tina and Emily talk about what it took to develop the FBI transcript into a play, bringing it to life, and why this story is an important one to be told. Let's listen.
I had vaguely heard of Reality Winner and the case in 2017 when it was happening, but hadn't really paid attention, very vaguely heard of it. And then I came upon a feature article on Reality in New York Magazine in December 2017 and was fascinated by this young woman I was reading about. And then in that article, it led me to this PDF of the transcript of the day she was interrogated at her home by the FBI in June 2017. And this transcript was really fascinating, and it immediately felt like a play to me as I was reading it. And the other thing that was really kind of intriguing at that moment was that physically I was not looking at pictures of Reality Winner in the article, and she looked a lot like Emily Davis, this incredible actress I had worked with for years. So I was sort of like, whoa, this feels like a play, and Emily could play Reality. So those were the very earliest stages for me thinking of it. And then I immediately sent this transcript. I emailed it to Ems and said, what do you think of this?
And it was hard. I have a hard time reading things off of screens, and the way that what Tina sent me was just the actual transcript before it had been, you know, untouched as it was in the Politico?
Politico had published the leaked PDF of this FBI transcript.
And Tina said, Ems, you could play her. There's just something here. This is just really interesting. Like, if you have a minute, you should read it. And I started reading it, but it was really hard for me I could see that there was, the first thing I think I noticed was Reality's, the animals kept coming up, which was, I was like, oh, I get why Tina's into this. Because that's been sort of a recurring motif in a lot of our work with Half Straddle, I would say, right?
Yes.
But
yes. These were real animals.
So I was starting to see these were real animals, yes, but I was starting to see these glimpses of, also, I could kind of hear Reality's humor, and just the way I felt like I immediately could hear her voice, And she stuck out as an interesting part of the transcript. But to me, I couldn't feel it as a play. My brain doesn't have the writer's, but I just didn't experience it as Tina did. But then, these were back in the days when we were living together, and unfortunately, like, not because I won't get into that, but we had this idea that we would, Tina was like, we should read this out loud. So then we sort of started,
yeah,
bringing whatever innocent bystander.
Yeah, the transcript called for four participants, as it literally listed on this. And in many ways, the transcript actually looked a lot like a play script. It truly did. We didn't make that many changes when we transported it over to a working script once the project was up and running as a play. And in real life, reality was ultimately visited by 11 agents that day at her home. But the transcript called for four people in this transcript. Reality herself, it named two agents that are the main agents interrogating her, Agent Taylor and Agent Garrick. And then this fourth character fourth participant was listed as unknown male, which was sort of these non sequiturs. And then we came to realize was probably the nine other men's voices being picked up on the things.
Yeah.
So, but in these early days of like, is this actually something we could do as a project and as a play? We tried to get three other people in the room with us. And we did this a number of times to read two other agents and unknown male. And it was anyone that to us had like male energy felt important. They did not have to be a cis male, but that was also sort of a new step for us in Half Straddle. But some version of male energy felt really important in the dynamic. So for like a month, I'd say every week we try to get together, sometimes literally in our apartment, sometimes in rehearsal spaces, and read this out loud. And then we'd be like, there is something there. Each time it became a little more clear. So yeah, so of course it was like, you know, Emily was going to be reality. That was like the pivotal casting that made it possible. And then it was like this idea that these, the three other characters that were called for per the transcript and we were going to try to stick with was the two main agents and then this unknown male figure. And I had this strong instinct that for this show and play, this male energy should be up there, and whatever that kind of meant. And it meant something to me. And I think as Emily and I were talking, it meant something to both of us then. And so we just called in a number of actors that I just, many of them friends, many we'd worked with before, people we'd wanted to work to just read it in this sort of, you know, it was we were very transparent with everyone we brought in to read, because we don't usually do actually auditions.
Oh my God, yeah, it was hilarious. Watching Tina conduct an audition.
But they were,
it was great. I mean, we just don't, it's not like, there was no casting person. We didn't cast it traditionally. It was we worked with
very
so
holistic.
Many wonderful actors, and it just came down to this like thing of,
we'd say,
something.
Do you want to come read this? We are looking to cast it, but it's also finding this energy in us just getting to experience it. And everyone we invited to do that was very open to that invitation and happy to play around with the text. And some people came into the room that we had never worked with before, but we were just private fans of, and wrote.
Yeah.
And we're again candid that this is sort of an audition, but and then to exactly echo what Em's just said, it was really what I then was looking for as I look at Emily in it was this, like any casting, but like this energy field that was going to be very important, because we knew we wanted this really stark set, and that these four actors were going to stand on this stark set, and this very intense conversation is going to unfold over an hour, and this just the usual intangible magic of casting, but who brings that? And
it was a puzzle too. It was totally a puzzle, because we think, well, he could play this, or they could play this, but then we'd need to move this to that, right? I mean,
surprising. The two main agents are the really kind of lead agent on the page appears to be someone named Agent Garrick, and then his wingman, is very present, is Agent Taylor. And it was really interesting. I mean, even though it's just this interrogation, and it's not like an hour in these characters' lives, after a number of reads, we could really suss out the vibe of a Taylor and the vibe of a Garrick. And, you know, someone would come in and it, you could be like, oh, they read it, Taylor, and switch it. And like, they're more interesting at Garrick. And it was just such intangibles in a certain way. And then Unknown Male was a real fascinating thing to cast because it was these hilarious non sequitur. I mean, that felt like, you know, we really come out of a downtown pedagogy and lineage in a certain way of how we've traditionally worked and made plays and who's been inspiring to the Hofstadter work in general, although there's a lot more to say about that. So this text that Unknown Male was saying as in the transcript was really, it felt like, oh my God, this is like downtown fodder, these random things. But we also wanted to treat this really dryly and with a lot of rigor. So it wasn't just making a joke. So it was like, what kind of actor? That was almost the hardest one to get the right role on, because if an actor tried to really play it a certain way, it didn't hold. So,
and then of course, hilariously, after months of agonizing over the casting, we ended up just going with three people that we'd worked with.
I had personally never worked with T.L. Thompson, but had seen them and been a huge fan of them. Yeah,
and I knew.
Yeah, but I mean, I think what Emily is saying, and just I mean, these actors know it, but it wasn't like we were immediately like Pete Simpson or Becca or T.L. I mean, they were dream people to read. But they really like just the alchemy. And I mean, I don't know, Becca would have a lot of their own thoughts. They're so incredible as Unknown Male. And it's really a very, very specific role and very hard technically. And Emily could speak more to that, but it actually is. And Becca just, the more I kept watching them, it was so clear what they could make with that part was going to be very special with the kind of humor, physicality, and edge of what male menace could mean. And I'm really seriously, what does it mean to have a male body on stage? And Becca was just really the perfect person to create that role with ultimately. So it became clear Becca should be Unknown Male. So,
in many ways, Is This a Room is a departure from Hofstadter's signature pieces. Let's listen as Tina and Emily discuss working in a new genre while staying true to the company's mission.
Yes, it is a detour because it's all the previous plays that we have worked on to full production, I have written the text for. So this was is like, not only did I not write it, but it's not even, you know, originally theatrical text. We were taking highly topical, still unfolding news fodder as a subject of a live person. Every other play that I've written is also like these very made up worlds and made up figures. So that it was a huge departure. And then, I mean, to use that many sort of male, quote unquote, energy bodies in a space was also a pretty big departure in what I'm usually interested in. But because it focused on this extremely dynamic and complicated female central figure, that felt really, really rooted to our work prior. And there was also a way we were going to more starkly treat design, but even that I can see coming out of our earlier work. And so the really quick ways I see it as not a huge departure at all, really, in many ways, is this central female figure. And then the way that I'm staging it, we ended up working the staging, actually you can see the roots of that kind of onstage choreography paired with text in earlier plays. But then, I don't know, Ems would have thoughts too.
I mean, I think that for about 10 years, I've been working with Tina and Hofstadter, and we are a company. There's, you know, 10, at least I would say, repeat offenders in the group. And so it's definitely a different feeling to not be up there with, you know, Jess or Eliza or Julia or Aaron or, you know, we've like worked with other actors from other downtown companies too, but there's you know, typically Chris Jarmo is like a long time
composer
for the company. And we didn't work with Chris for this show just because of, you know, a lot of different things. And we're working with Sanaa
Yamada.
He was
touring with David Byrne and we couldn't.
Yeah, he was a little
busy. But it was one of those amazing things, amazing for him. And then we got to work with someone really exciting as well. So
it's just, you know, working with, I mean, of course, Becca has been in a lot of Tina's work, and we have sort of a relationship on stage with each other that's hard to not always feel it'll just always be there. Like, I have said this about Tina's work before in the past, no matter what the task at hand is, it does sort of feel like at the end of the day, we're all just trying to make each other, like we're all just cutting up on stage and trying to make each other break character. It feels like the true motivation of each moment. And then Tina, you know, dips her hand in and makes us all get back to work, and then also not get back to work. Cause I think that like, playing around, I mean, I know this sounds so cheesy in every theater, whatever, but so much of the work that Tina has generated has been based on the relationships of the actors of the company. Right. So yes. Like writing about Jess or Julia or Olivia, right. You know, these like friendships into it and what has come out of them and just who we are. People,
our dynamics,
Yeah.
Get lifted and then played out, not in any one recognizable way, but they are the fodder usually of.
Yeah.
The,
and
what
so
we're making, no matter what the content is.
And but so for this, it's just a different playing field. But at the same time, we've still, because of the particular energies of this group of people, it's felt like a half straddle room, like in the sense that there's a lot of laughs, a lot of tears, mostly me or Tina sometimes. But yeah, yeah. I mean, I also feel like it in terms of how Tina works with me as a director, which is very, very different than how other directors work with me. This does not feel like a departure at all. I feel like we have our way of working together and we have our shorthand. And even though the content and the structure of this play is wildly different sometimes, you know, I still feel like you and I have the same
way into it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, cause this is so true of any project. So this is going to sound cliche too, but even in our past works, the way I think I came to theater with a kind of different background than many theater makers, each project is like, this is truly an experiment. Can this hold? Can what we want to do hold? And this completely did, because it really, we didn't know. It wasn't like I had written a play and I'm like, I've got our three-act play. It was like, is this theatrical? Can we make a play? So I think that half-straddle vibe, I think that is something usually in the whole process of like, we're going to make this and we're all going to lean into this and do this now in this work period. But I think that's, you know, usually an artistic thing. And then one other technical thing that I also think always in the plays and shows we've made, even when I've written them, I'm always interested in really specific semantics of a given group, whether it's like high school people or a sports mm-hmm. team or a dance class. And a real gift of this text was this very, very specific security language that, fascinatingly, not only did the agent speak, but because of reality's role, she speaks a security language, which is how she had access to the information that she was ultimately got in trouble for. But not every leaker has that. And so there's this amazing thing throughout the script of all this very specific language that we got to play with as actors and the makers, yeah.
Yeah, it was, I think, the first time we've ever done, like, table work, too. We actually had to sit down and work together with two of these incredible residencies that we had in Berkeley and at Dartmouth to sort of to figure out what reality, what the actual journey of reality is in that 1 hour and where her mind is going
right.
And thought to thought. I mean,
well,
because it's verbatim and because so much of the script is her talking through, to me, what I experience of it is her talking through different versions of truth and what the truth is going to be and what her reality is, of course, no pun intended. But so that's that's a microscopic.
Right. And because
dramaturgical,
it was real.
I mean, yeah, we really had to talk through every single moment together.
You say PAKI password. Like, PAKI password sounds like something I would have made up to be high school slang for in the Pony Pals football. But it's real. And so we weren't like super worried, but we wanted to have logic as smart actors and the whole thing have integrity that when they said PAKI password, they knew what that meant, even if no one in the audience, except for the one FBI guy, I think, who saw it at the kitchen, knows what that is. So, yeah.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFF's creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. Suf's The Original New Musical from Shana Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.
I mean, directorially, a way to figure it out at first was to try to not make any choices and to be like, we are going to adhere to every word and syllabic breakdown on the page. So as you watched it, I mean, especially like the main agent, Pete, he's stuttering a lot. He is doing almost every stutter on the page. Every sneeze is in the transcript because for some reason the transcript notes sneezes and coughs. So it was like, we are going to just do this, which is actually a really old-fashioned play thing. Like, what is on the page? And then let's do that. So to me, the way in was to, like, take it with it full integrity from the page and take any clues from there and then let any sort of artistry, edging, molding that had to come from what we learned there. And then the other big choice that I would make, I made artistically, I think, that was to not have any set, and we're just going to hear this and watch these people move on this stark set. So somehow that felt the way to create the laboratory to let the language tell us how it should feel and even look on stage.
It's hard to articulate, I think, what the process of working on this
right.
was. I mean, there were definite moments of, like, I think one of the first things that you did with Mariana was break it down into an actual script.
Right.
To break it up into scenes. And then you and I then started looking at the idea of what these acts would be.
Yeah, we did actually, we ultimately made it into a 3-act play, which once we realized it was so clear.
But it was Tina had cracked something. I mean, you cracked something
that
made you feel like, I mean, not to give too much away for people who, I think we all know what ends up happening to reality, but there is a natural sort of way that it did break down into those 3 acts where one of the real challenges for us became figuring out how to keep the tension through the entire piece when
I mean, she admits what she did.
When she has already admitted.
But they keep interrogating her, and their interrogation on one version has a very similar rhythm. Over and over, they do the same kind of thing. So to feel that out. But I also think on your personal thing, like some of your choice around voice and stuff was really interesting, like this way to lightly make this a character and the kind of realistic or naturalism that you came to, which kind of became a way in for that we found with all the actors. I don't know. I mean, maybe that is hard to talk about still.
I just think that maybe an old school, for all my years of theater training, I actually don't know how to talk about this acting process stuff, technique, whatever. But I would think that normally if you look at a script and you're trying to decide what your motivation is, then you're thinking about, like, how do I say this? I feel like for reality, I had to think about the words coming out of her mouth as a direct evasion of everything that she was actually thinking, which is not to say she's lying through the whole thing, because she's not. But it's interesting to think about how, I mean, I'm kind of doing it right now, right? Because I don't know what I'm talking about, but I'm continuing to go, and you both are being very generous, like, letting me do it. But there's so much, there's 2 tracks happening in this person, and a lot of the language in the play, I think, is reality sort of buying time or trying to figure out, because she also, one of the biggest questions we had was, did she know as soon as she saw them what they were there for? Or does she really not know? There's all these things, and I can't answer that question. I've been in touch with reality. I still would never try to answer that question. I don't know the answer to that. I don't think you do either.
I think it's like
a lot of this was guesswork. We definitely took a lot of liberties. We've in terms of thinking about what her motivation was in each moment. But does that make sense? I basically just thought about, I mean, this goes back to what I was saying about us looking at every single line to figure out, why would she say that? And why the choice to include that little bit of information? Is she ingratiating herself with them in this moment? And then to me, thinking about, I mean, one of the things that really, I think, struck both of us in reading it was how accommodating she is. She's so, she has a sense of humor. She's very kind. She's, it seems like she's being very, very, very open with them. And so what's going on there? It's just a huge, there's, it's just a really weird.
Right. So
I don't know how to.
So like for Emily, it was important to her in ways that I totally make sense. So we would talk through, because normally we don't really ever work very psychologically at
all, as an approach. Never.
So it was still that, and then that allowed, I mean, Emily's performance is just so beautiful, but so then and then Emily would push for us to talk about that, and it would always be helpful for me too. But I always also have to step back, and it's like what trumps almost all of that is a rhythm that the whole piece has to have, mm-hmm. like in my brain. So it's like, okay, but it was like, I don't know, it's hard to talk about. It's just literally, it's our work, but we get in the room, you run it. You're now layering in a slight read on a line. And then you start to see, all right, if Pete steps to you there, what do we get? That's like the magic of knitting together. The way this play works, which is this mix of movement, realistic acting, but not in any specific literal set. So, yeah.
Emily has been in contact with Reality Winner, and Tina has been in touch with Reality's mother. Here they tell us how their correspondence began.
I wrote to, I mean, it's been a while. I think, unfortunately, when she was in Coswell, which was in Fort Worth, or no, I'm sorry, that's where she is now. The place, the jail where she was before, she was able to use the internet to correspond. And so I signed up for something called Jail Mail. I think that's what it was called. And I wrote to her one day, just sort of, I knew that she knew what was happening, but I just wanted to introduce myself and just say hello. And she wrote me back a super long letter immediately. And I was... Yeah. I remember I was like walking through Greenpoint and I got this notification, and it just almost, for some reason, it just felt so fake. Like I was like, who's playing around? And then it was this long, incredible letter from this person who had the same voice. I mean, from her. I mean, yeah. I think I called Tina immediately and it was crazy.
It was also, I don't know, it was the week of the Christine Blasey Ford trial. This letter where Reality says, I tried to stay calm that day. I don't know. That's just a major side note to life, but it felt, I will never forget it because that was already such weird days. Mm-hmm. Emily read this letter to me that starts out with Emily, hey girl. And it was Reality. It was very incredible because mostly she just seemed.
She just wanted to
funny and playful and honest the way we had gleaned from the year of working with this hour in her life under extremely intense circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, her mother, Billy Winter Davis, who found out about the project initially, did mention to us that Reality was really nervous, you know, that she was afraid of people thinking, you know, hearing this interview and making the worst assumptions about her. And I don't know, there was something about that too that was like, I felt like I didn't want to take for granted that we were also sharing something really personal and something that she could have potentially thought was damning. I wanted her to understand sort of where we were coming from. And I don't remember what I wrote to her, but it was, you know, I think I was more formal with her. And then she wrote this letter back that was just like right to my heart. And so we wrote back and forth a couple of times. And then she got moved, and where she is now, it's much harder for her to get mail. I've written to her again, but I haven't heard back. We get updates from her mom.
Yeah.
And I know Tina's been in touch with her sister as well.
Tina and Emily came to the theater from very different backgrounds. Next, we hear how they came to be artists and collaborators.
I didn't train at theater in high school or college or anything. As it turns out, most of the Hofstadtl people were went to conservatories at 18. So I'm constantly learning from them, caught up a little bit now, but, but my first influence in was being someone who sort of more was like had an artistic mind. And before I even realized I could make theater, came upon the writings of Richard Foreman the work of the Worcester Group and Richard Maxwell. So I, you know, I cite those as like, I was just a, like someone interested in art and interested in reading, learned about those three, you know, art makers as people making any work in the world. And I was like, oh, this is a way to do something to process these ideas I have as this kind of specific version of theater. So going, almost skipping like class, I mean, I've been to plays and I had been an English major and stuff, but I almost skipped like the Aristotelian way in and was immediately and deeply influenced by that more, experimental theater. And then—
But you're an athlete too, so that yes, totally like—
Yes, I think, affected. And sports totally too. So yeah, and then for those two, then starting to make work in New York City, going to grad school at Brooklyn College with Mack Wellman, and then immediately the peers I became lucky enough to work with, like Emily Davis, Jess Barbagallo, Chris Giarmo, and the rest, learning from them, oh, what you're doing is viewpoints. I'm like, oh, you know. So I, anyways, that's my way in. And yeah, and sports is big, but yeah.
I went to an arts magnet high school in Dallas. And before that, went to an arts middle school. And then before that, went to a Montessori school that really prioritized theater as well. So I've been extremely theatered.
Like, you knew it was what you were really interested in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's like one of the only things I know how to do. I mean, that's not true. But no, definitely. I've been on I always knew I wanted to move to New York and be a waitress and an actress. And I have gotten to be both many, many times and probably for the rest of my life. But I worked, I met Tina because Jess Barbagallo, who was a sort of art star at NYU when I went there, who would just sort of like, I don't know, there was something really captivating and devilish and cool about this little redheaded
And he
person.
Is the associate director of our vineyard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's working
and
on this,
like,
too,
kind
by
of
the way.
A seminal person. He couldn't be in the show originally. He was, because he was doing Harry Potter on Broadway.
Can't make this shit
but
up.
But so he was, he was seminal. But anyways,
well,
keep going.
He just, I was in some of his work, or no, I know what it was. It was a class on downtown theater at NYU. Was what brought me to Jess Barbagallo, who then recommended me for Tina's, a play that Tina wrote called Family that was at the Ontological Hysteric Theater by St. Mark's, RIP. And that was a show where I played Tina. I played a version of Tina. Yes. So it was sort of fast track to like yes. getting, understanding her heart. And I very quickly learned like, man, this woman is funny. I'd also not worked with any, I was so young, but I hadn't worked with any women. And that was all
so weird.
That was in this company. And I was like, what the fuck have I been doing all this time? This stuff is funny and smart and they're total weirdos. The only thing she says is like faster, slower, weirder. but I got it. There was something about her aesthetic. There was something, I was also just super turned on by her relationship to like the art world. I felt like, I was so used to seeing such ugly theater or like things that just looked bad. And I just thought, why would you make something that looked, I mean, I might sound terribly conceited when I say this, but I do think that Tina's, that's like such a strong, that for me, that was right. just such a.
The aesthetic.
Yeah.
The attention being attended.
The
yeah.
neuroses around every particle and hair follicle like on stage was, to me, I just felt like it was this kind of ambition that I really wanted to be close to. I wanted to be working with someone who was that detail oriented.
In our final segment, Emily and Tina share their personal reasons for bringing this piece to life and what they hope this play will accomplish.
I did not go seeking this kind of piece. I was actually working on, I had a commission from the kitchen, so I was working away on another very made up kind of thing of it about like these adult women. But it's obviously been really crazy times or very specific times to live in the U.S. And I think as an artist where your brain is attuned, and mine definitely is, to like, what is discourse? How do we think about these things? And have been thinking about them in a more heightened crucible since the winter of 2015 winter of 2016 leading up to the election. I mean, through that whole... when they were running for office, and that was really crazy, I think. And so just to say, when I came to this and was so fascinated by the character of reality, I was immediately like, this person is a version of a patriot. Like, this is a really complicated young patriot. And I really, like, and I was like, this is so fascinating. Immediately made me rethink, oh my God, what do I think? What does it mean for me to, like, love or not love my country? Does that matter? And in these times, and so immediately I was just like, I want to see this kind of content treated theatrically. You could read about reality, you could read the transcript, you could read an amazing profile of her. We can hear her discussed on Democracy Now! Or Fox News, but there's more reality, and as much as reality, the attending issues to this moment of, like, information in this age, information that protects our state or doesn't protect our state, how are people punished? I want to put a heart and brain around that too. I want there to be discourse of this kind of content in this moment that is artistically treated. And it felt like that was a huge step towards that I never had set out, like, to do that. Here's the content to do that. As we were on the content, and I mean, we did talk about this in the year then that Emily and I, and then as more collaborators joined us, and especially the group of actors that we worked with that will do it at the Vineyard, we would talk, this is what it feels good to be spending our time on, with no real answers of what it doesn't give you answers, but it gives you a heartbeat connection to what does feel like important content. So, very long-winded answer to your question, but is just putting that content out there with only an artistic lens, not a lens that, like, reality is a hero or not a hero, but this happened in America in this time. There's a whole bunch of issues around it. Just sit with it and sit in this personal way into this human, because we have this incredible record. This happened an hour one day in Georgia in June 2017. It had huge issues. It really did, because what she leaked was evidence of Russian interference in our election. So let's take that fact in. This is a moment that happened, and let's just, yeah, take it in the ways that doing it in a live theater allow us.
I think you said it. I mean, I don't know if you're doing this, Tina, but I still Google reality every day, because nothing comes up. Like, she's just not written about. You know, there's a couple of articles, but seriously, if you try to Google her, a picture of us is one of the first things that comes up.
Right,
I've that. In that picture. No, but like, it's just shocking to me that it doesn't get more coverage, but I'm becoming less and less shocked. I think it's just, these are, as Tina said, unfortunately, I think people are falling through, a lot of whistleblowers on her heels as well are falling through the cracks and really scary ways. But even though she is discussed on Democracy Now! Sometimes, I don't know if you saw something on Fox.
No, I just threw that out there. I mean, I would be curious actually to Google if she ever has been.
The Times reported when she was sentenced, and then there's been a couple of, there's a handful of journalists in Texas, most notably at the Caller Times and Corpus Christi, that I have a connection to because my grandfather was a wrote for the Caller Times for a really
and
long
that's
time.
Like reality's home turf is the Corpus
yeah,
Christi
South Texas.
Area.
I have a big South Texas connection with this whole thing, but there's some people at that paper write about reality a lot, and I think in Kingsville. But beyond that, she doesn't get much airtime at all. So
no.
For me, I do think I want people to see this, and you know, when I have conversations with people, it then sends them down the rabbit hole of
always,
like,
yeah.
I can't believe I've never heard about this person. This is so crazy. So I want to send people down rabbit holes.
I mean, every time we just did it again. As soon as the show's over, you'll see people on their phones. Like happened in Europe. They're looking at, wait, what? This happened?
But we also, we just got back from Europe with this, right? And maybe Tina mentioned this, but the biggest thing that we experienced right off the bat was people not knowing that it was, people thinking it was fictionalized.
Right.
And thinking, like, what an interesting piece of writing. I mean, they just sort of were ready to say that out loud more than I think American audiences in a way. Like, it's just plain as day to them that it's, that there's a it's problematic how this woman was treated, how she was interrogated, and that she was then imprisoned for it.
That's it for this episode of Theater Uncorked. Thanks to Tina Satter and Emily Davis for joining us on the podcast. Peter Uncorked is produced and edited by me, Kevin Weinbold, with help from the Vineyard's marketing director, Melissa Pelkey. Thanks to the Vineyard Theater's artistic directors, Douglas Abel and Sarah Stern, and managing director, Suzanne Appel, along with the entire Vineyard staff. Thanks to Peter Lerman for creating the theme music to our podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on iTunes. And last but not least, a special thanks to you for listening to Theater Uncorked at the Vineyard.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.